Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang in Creationism podcast. The title of this week's podcast is The History of Pre-Evolutionary Thought. As this title might hint, this week's episode is going to be discussing the concepts of evolution and the debates before Darwin's time. We're mainly going to focus on what Gould called functionalism versus formalism. And the creationist claim for this week is going to be on the plesiosaur caught by a Japanese trawler in the late 70s. But before we get into that, we're going to be discussing a bit more news that came out during the past week, since I'm starting on Monday. This is last week's news, technically. And this is two more bills were struck down in two states, Wisconsin and South Carolina. Now, South Carolina's bill required the critical thought that we always see in these creationist ID bills. It says critical thought in each academic content, and yet it went on to complain only about biology standards. So you can see, once again, that they're talking about the teach the controversy issue, and yet they're only going to discuss it in terms of biology. Wisconsin's bill, however, was trying to ban the non-natural sciences, aka creationism or intelligent design, and it got rejected. So this bill's purpose was mainly to kick out creationism and intelligent design, make them not allowed in the public school systems because they are not science. And this bill was actually rejected, so Wisconsin apparently wants to leave the science classrooms open to intelligent design or creationism. I thought that was kind of sad and bizarre at the same time. So that is the news for this week, and we will hop now right into the creationist claim. This creationist claim I've kind of had a history with. Last year, I was talking with a creationist at my school, and he brought this up, and my friend happened to look into the claim just a tiny bit, and he became a creationist for about an hour before I talked with him and kind of talked him out of it and showed him that this claim really has nothing, there's no basis to it. It's just misinformation and kind of going away with this myth that this creature is actually a plesiosaur instead of what it actually is, which was a shark. So I've had a little bit of history with this claim. My friend and I kind of laugh about it because he was a creationist for a little bit. But so without further ado, we're just going to talk about the claim and why it's actually wrong. But we'll talk about the basis of the claim first, which is this. This claim was based off of a catch that a Japanese trawler made in 1977. This was a fishing boat owned by a company called Taiyo Fishery Company, and it picked up this 2-ton creature about 1,000 feet below the surface, somewhere around New Zealand and Australia, around there. And they were going to toss this creature overboard because it was going to spoil their fish, but it accidentally slipped out of the rigging and fell onto the deck. And a graduate from an oceanological school examined the creature, and he took some photographs and some measurements of it. Now, in the beginning, there was speculation. There was a tiny bit of speculation that got exaggerated extremely to the amount that people were beginning to think that this thing was actually a plesiosaur, which is, of course, an extinct dinosaur. Now, the idea of this plesiosaur is obviously going to seem a lot more attractive than it being just another dead carcass, just a shark that they found that happened to rot and looked like this plesiosaur, so of course the idea is going to get spread around. People like myths more than the truth, it seems. So what this plesiosaur actually is what's known as a basking shark. Now, basking sharks feed on plankton, and they can grow really, really large, which looks like this creature is fairly large. They can grow up to lengths of 40 feet. They've been reported. I don't think people have recorded these in peer-reviewed journals, but 40 feet is the lengths that have been reported of these creatures. But the interesting part that applies to us, at least, is how these creatures decay. What do their corpses look like when they decay? Well, the soft parts of their body kind of slough off, and what remains of the corpse greatly resembles the bones of a plesiosaur. And people have recognized this for a long time. They even called basking corpse sharks pseudo-plesiosaurs because they look so much like the plesiosaur. Also, there was tissue samples taken from this creature that were tested, and the amino acids from one of them, from the basking shark, were compared with the amino acids from this carcass that they found, and they matched pretty much perfectly. So it was, without a doubt, a basking shark. There's no basis for this claim, aside from speculation, of course, that this creature was once or happened to be a plesiosaur, and that we have plesiosaurs and other dinosaurs actually living around in the earth, hiding in under the surface, waiting to be found, and that somehow this gives credence to the claim that dinosaurs lived alongside man, because they still do, and we get into some weird, bizarre issues with creationism like that. So, once we solve this Japanese trawler plesiosaur issue, then we kind of help get rid of this notion that man once lived alongside dinosaurs, which is, of course, preposterous. We know that's false today. But that's what this creationist claim was trying to show incorrect. And, of course, it was wrong in itself. So that is the creationist claim for this week. All right, without any hesitation, let's go right into the science topic for this week, which is the history of pre-evolutionary thought. Now, for this topic, I'm going to be relying almost solely on Gould's The Structure of Evolutionary Theory. This book is pretty interesting, it's fairly thick, it weighs about 5 pounds, so if anyone would like to check it out and see for themselves what Gould actually has to say, I'm just going to summarize the first four chapters, that basically go on to discuss the whole history of evolution before Darwin, what the main arguments were all about. And so Gould does a great job explaining this. He kind of goes into asides here and there, and it's one of the main complaints I've seen in reviews of Gould's book, that he kind of goes off and talks on tangents a lot. But I haven't found this too troublesome, and I've found Gould's book very helpful in understanding what the history of evolutionary theory actually is. So I'd recommend go checking it out. Again, it's The Structure of Evolutionary Theory by Stephen Jay Gould. All right, so before Darwin, nature was interpreted by natural theologians. It wasn't interpreted by biologists or just plain naturalists. They were natural theologians. And these men felt that they could detect the design in nature, and they would say it could tell us about the nature of God. One group of natural theologians thought that God was glorified by something known as functionalism. This is rather like the intelligent design argument. It says that in God's work, we can see his design because these creatures that we see in nature so easily fit the niches that they live in. So humans fit in their niche, birds fit in theirs, and these creatures fit so perfectly, they obviously had to have been designed to fit here. So it's obvious, it's really like the intelligent design argument that these things were designed perfectly, therefore there's a designer. Now, we have to remember that the aspect of history was absent, since many people believed the Earth was only about 6,000 to 10,000 years old. So there was no time for a process like natural selection to work, so it was thrown out of the options right away without being considered because the history aspect wasn't there. So this is what Darwin happened to add, this aspect of history, which made natural selection a viable mechanism for the creatures fitting their niches. However, there was one other side to this debate, and they were known as the formalists. These groups said that there was an overarching body plan, which kind of represented the designer's ideals for body plans. So we all have lungs and hearts and a certain skeletal structure, and they're basically the same for a large amount of creatures. And these formalists said, hey, these creatures all look the same. That's kind of like similar design from a single designer. So they said we can see God, and he is evident in the fact that there's an overarching basic body structure to these creatures. This is also similar to the ID or creationist claim about the Cambrian explosion, all the basic body types being created there. So that's how we can kind of see how the history of evolutionary thought has kind of resurfaced, and we see all these old claims being used again. Now, one thing should be noted, and that is that formalists didn't totally reject functionalism, but they simply said it was secondary to the overarching structure of things. So formalists said, structure is the main thing, but the fact that we can see creatures fit their niches, well, that's a secondary aspect. And the same was true for functionalists. They did not totally reject formalism, but they said that we can mainly tell about the nature of God from functionalism. Now, there were huge debates over which one was correct. Is it formalism? Is it functionalism? Is it both? There were a lot of arguments from both sides and a lot of famous characters we see. First, we had the famous functionalist William Paley. Now, this name might be familiar to some of you. He's famous for his watchmaker argument, which is still used by creationists and intelligent design advocates to this day, which is basically, we can see a watch, obviously it was designed for a purpose, therefore this tree or this bird was designed for a purpose, because it's complex and it looks like it has some intent, some purpose. And this was first brought up in William Paley's book, Natural Theology. So as I just stated, he saw the watch and he said this watch was designed for a purpose, it has all these complex parts. So he compared the perfect adaptation of creatures to their environments as evidence of a kind of purpose, a guiding force, which is of course created by intelligence. Now, a problem with this view is obvious, and I've gone over it in other previous episodes, for instance, the one where I critiqued Stephen C. Meyer's and Peter Ward's debate, or discussion, as I should say. I keep thinking it's a debate. So the problem with this view is quite obvious. And, of course, Paley had some very bizarre conclusions about the nature of God based in his studies, about the perfect fit of creatures. For instance, the purpose of pain shows the benevolence of God, because we feel good when the pain goes away, so the pain is just there to make us feel good when it's gone. And also, he believed that God made life so that it would, and I quote, deter men and women from sluttishness and sordidness, and to provide them to cleanliness and neatness. God himself hateth uncleanliness and turns away from it. So lice just solely exist to make sure we clean ourselves. Very bizarre thing. Now, Paley's counterpart in this argument was a man named Louis Agassiz, and I'm sorry if I butcher the French names, there are a lot of them here. And Louis Agassiz was a European who had migrated to America. He was one of the major American natural theologians at the time. But unlike Paley, he was a formalist. He regarded taxonomy, as you might think, taxonomy is the classification of different creatures on the planet. He regarded taxonomy as very high and great science because it was essentially, to him, a study of God's thoughts. They were basic body creatures that were less perfect in the material world, but God had these kind of perfect plans. If anyone's familiar with Plato's shapes, it's in a similar manner. God has these perfect designs, but when he realizes them in the material world, they're not as perfect, and they kind of stray from this basic body plan. But this basic plan, of course, is evidence of God's divine creative force, according to Agassiz. So similar structure to Agassiz is evidence of a same designer. Now, Paley and Agassiz kind of disappear from the scene. I believe Agassiz went on and kind of argued against Darwin. He wrote a book, actually, just shortly before Darwin's main book on the Origin of Species came out. And Agassiz was around, I believe, until 1873 or sometime around there. However, other formalists came onto the scene. One formalist named J.W. von Goethe carried on Agassiz's legacy, and he was arguing again that the similarity amongst creatures indicates a common designer. However, we had a new functionalist also appear on the scene, and his name was Georges Cuvier, who was at one time good friends with a man named Geoffrey. And the debate between these two men, because Geoffrey happened to be a formalist, it kind of turned them from friends into bitter rivals. Now, Cuvier was pretty clever, and he wanted to destroy this formalist argument. He said that these similar looks between creatures were simply evidences of similar functions shared by almost all creatures. So form was still subordinate to their function. For instance, just the fact that every creature on land has lungs doesn't indicate that they were designed the same way. It just means that they were all fitted to the same niche, that is, they all need to breathe air. So function is more telling of the nature of God than, say, formalism. So the lungs being the same type, it really doesn't have to do anything with a common design. It has to do with common purpose. So that's how Cuvier decided to say, well, formalism really doesn't tell you anything. So these wide types of forms indicated a common function, and specific adaptations recorded the local functions. So humans have fingers, but not all creatures have fingers. I have a local function I need to perform, and it's solely restricted to me and other creatures like me. And Cuvier stated that no creatures have parts that are just there for the sake of fitting some overarching type. So there wouldn't be, say, vestigial organs. We wouldn't have an appendix because, well, it really doesn't do anything. It just fits this common body structure. So with that, we can kind of see Cuvier's claim here is wrong because we know vestigial organs exist. They don't do the function that they used to do in other creatures. They're just there to fit the form. Now, Geoffrey, on the other hand, he sought to strengthen the formalist view. Now, a little going into the past to see what Geoffrey is trying to fix. Before Geoffrey came around, there were four basic body plans. There were the radiata, which are creatures like jellyfish, which are radially symmetric, that is, they're symmetric in a sort of spherical or circular shape. There are the articulata, which are segmented creatures, mollusca, and vertebrata. Now, what Geoffrey wanted to do was he wanted to unite all of these four body plans into one overarching structure. Now, he was able to unite all of them except radiata, when two men, Mayron and Lawrence, I'm sorry again if I butchered those names, introduced an article of theirs on how mollusca might be homologous to vertebrata. And, of course, Geoffrey had not yet united mollusca, and he was about to do so. So Geoffrey, when he saw this paper, was kind of overjoyed, but Cuvier, when he heard about it, was really, really upset, and, you know, he couldn't let this actually occur. He couldn't let mollusca be united with these other body plans so that Geoffrey would almost have completed his goal of uniting all four of them into one body plan, which would say, here's one body plan, it's obvious there's one designer. So Cuvier demolished this claim that the two men, Mayron and Lawrence, made about mollusca, a scientific argument, and then a kind of rhetorical argument to say, well, formalism really isn't a good idea, it doesn't have anything going for it, functionalism is actually what explains the nature of God. And so Mayron and Lawrence were never actually heard of again, and Gould kind of talks a little bit about these poor guys who just wanted to introduce a paper, and then they were totally shut down by Cuvier, and they were never heard from again after that, and no one really knows anything about them. So Cuvier wanted to actually debate Geoffrey, and so they did in 1830 over the functionalism versus formalism at the Academy of Sciences. Now, Gould says that most textbooks say that Cuvier actually won the debate. But Geoffrey was able to get the last word in edgewise because Cuvier died 12 years before Geoffrey in 1832. So Geoffrey had all that time to say what he thought about the debate and discover more about formalism and why functionalism, to him, was wrong. Now, this debate of functionalism versus formalism went on until Charles Darwin's time. And when Darwin came around and he understood that the Earth was not actually just 6,000 to 10,000 years old, but a lot older than that, they didn't have specific dating until we got into the era of carbon dating and other radiometric types of dating. But when Darwin did this, he added the aspect of history to this debate. No longer was functionalism and formalism the only two options. Now we had a natural selection, a natural force that could act over time, which would eventually lead to this notion that these creatures that were apparently designed for where they are, they weren't actually designed. It's just, you take all the mutations, I'm going to use this example, if we took all these variations of creatures, and we stuck them through this filter, this funnel, which is natural selection, and out we only get a few certain strong and creatures that seem to fit into the environment that they lived in. It's only because they were able to pass through that filter of natural selection. And so here we have a purely natural force giving the illusion of design. But how does evolution account for the formalist argument that there's an overarching body plan in these creatures? What explains the similarity of, quote-unquote, design between these creatures? And we know that the body plans of creatures are constrained simply because if creatures had a variety of body plans, it would rule out natural selection as the seat of creativity, and it would put just random mutations in that seat. We know that there are tiny mutations in creatures that would result in a slight change here or there. But if we were to have mutations that would create whole new arms in single generations, then natural selection would not really be the creative force that would cause this diversification of life. It would be the variation itself. We would have creatures popping up with new arms, new legs, just new random organs all the time. And that would kind of rule out natural selection and make variation the center for creativity. Variations are small mutations, not ones large enough to create an entire body plan within a few generations. Natural selection acts upon what's already there, and it doesn't create the whole new structures itself. And if new structures do exist, they're going to be accumulated changes over a long period of time, which is, again, the history aspect of this debate changes everything. We have a whole new ball game, basically. And so this was just the overarching pre-evolutionary debate. It was formalism versus functionalism before Darwin's time. And again, when Darwin added this aspect of history to everything, we entered a whole new realm of discussion now that we got rid of the idea that the Earth is only 6 to 10,000 years old. Maybe when I read a bit more of Gould's book, I can actually sum up in its entirety what the book is actually about. From the reviews that I've read, it gets mixed reviews. Some say that Gould really isn't good at summing things up and he shouldn't actually try to do so. But others say this is a really good book. Gould discusses punctuated equilibria, which one of the main complaints is that Gould kind of talks highly of himself, and he goes on defending punctuated equilibria for like 300 pages, which isn't going to make for a very good read with Gould defending himself constantly. But other than that, the book seems to get pretty good reviews, and the history, I've learned a lot of history about evolution just by reading Gould's book alone. So, again, I would suggest it to anyone. I've done this a third time now, but if anybody wants to read this book, I would highly recommend it if you have a lot of time and you know a lot of vocabulary, because Gould seems to use words that I have never heard of, and he uses them quite often. So, have a dictionary on hand if you're going to read his book. And with the science topic cleared up now, we're going to be going over another definition. This definition is of a vestigial organ. People seem to have a bit of confusion about vestigial organs. They think they only apply to organs that don't have any function at all. And that's not totally what a vestigial organ is. A vestigial organ is an organ that used to have some original function, but has since changed that function, or that original function has been totally lost or weakened. An example is the appendix. Originally, this appendix was used to digest cellulose, and we can find this in other animals like rabbits. But today, though the appendix may have a different function, some people think it might have something to do with the immune system, the appendix has since lost its major function of cellulose digestion. So, a vestigial organ is an organ that once had some main original function, which has since lost that function, or has had it greatly reduced in strength. So again, the appendix used to digest cellulose, but now we see that it doesn't actually do that. It's actually used perhaps for immune system services or some other function like that, but it has since lost its major function of digesting cellulose. Well, everyone, this is the Big Bang and Creationism episode for this week. I'll give out my email. It is rlippins@wavecable.com. Send me your comments, questions, concerns. I love reading them, getting them, and writing back to you. So feel free to do that or post on the blog. Again, I'm looking at getting a website. I've been visiting various websites. If anyone has any suggestions for hosting services, you can email me with those as well, and I'll look into them. But until then, I guess I will be doing some reading on Gould's book, looking at other books, and just trying to get stuff for next week's episode of this podcast. I was looking into possibly doing a critique of another intelligent design book called Unlocking the Mystery of Life, which I watched last week and took some notes on. I was also planning on getting Icons of Evolution, which is a DVD that's a spin-off of Jonathan Wells' book, but I haven't gotten that yet. I thought I was going to get it in my DVD service, but I ended up getting a different movie. So I might have to hold off on that. I've also been trying to get some time to do an interview with someone else on the program that I have, so hopefully we'll be able to get that either the next week or the week after. So that's the basic plan for this month or the next few weeks, what I have planned. Well, until then, everyone, have a good week, and we will talk next time.